And welcome to another edition of the Odyssey Radio Show. We're on Monday evenings, and we talk about ancient mysteries and mystical topics. Today, we're going to be talking about pop music and mysticism and UFOs. And I have invited on an expert on the subject. He's written several books about rock and roll. Welcome to the show, Gary Patterson.
It's good to be with you, Mike. How are you?
Great. Thanks a lot. I'm a big fan of rock music, so we're going to have a lot of fun tonight and get into all the different groups and how they relate to mysticism and ghosts. So why don't we start with the birth of rock and roll. There's a blues musician named Robert Johnson. Why don't you tell us about the legend of how rock and roll started at the crossroads?
Well, you know, basically it was the whole concept that Robert Johnson, who was a poor sharecropper's son in Clarksville, Mississippi, and he wasn't a very good musician, though he really wanted to play the blues, and basically his first instrument was the harp, or the blues harp. And the old blues musicians would dodge him because they knew he was bad. But for some strange reason, and of course the legend is that Johnson had left to look for his father and went into Memphis. He was gone for a short time, a number of weeks, and when he came back, he was probably the most incredible guitarist in the Mississippi Delta. And when they heard him play, Son House turned to some of the other blues players and he said, you know, he sold his soul to play like that. Because there was a legend that if you went to a deserted country crossroads and you waited, that a large black man would appear. And he would take your guitar and he would tune it to a special tuning. And if he handed the guitar back and you accepted it, then you'd made a pact. And the pact was that you would have a short life, but you would have incredible fame. And that you would make a name for yourself as a blues musician. Now, what's interesting is that Robert Johnson never claimed to have sold his soul at the crossroads. Tommy Johnson did. He was another blues player, and his brother Liddell had told the story. If you've seen the movie Old Brother, Where Art Thou, it's Tommy Johnson they pick up at the crossroads, not Robert Johnson.
But no relation,
No relation. But the interesting part was that when Johnson played the roadhouses, the rumor had spread around the populace that this man had made a deal with Old Scratch to play the guitar so people would come to see him. And when he played, he had a cataract in one of his eyes, and when the light hit it, his eye would glow. And the people thought, well, this is the evil eye. And when he would play certain passages on his guitar, he'd turn his back to the audience so they couldn't see what he was doing. And, of course, he was trying to hide his guitar licks, but a lot of people thought that that was that mystical tuning and he had something to hide. And then one night, he took a drink out of a bottle of whiskey that had been opened, and it was poisoned. It was with strychnine. And according to the legend, it took him 3 days to die, and he died on his hands and knees howling like a dog at the age of 27 at the crossroads in Clarksville. So I think a lot of the British great blues guitarists, like Eric Clapton and Jimmy Page and even Keith Richards, when they'd heard the story of Johnson, it hooked them into the blues because his voice sounded so tormented. And right now there's a concept that the old blues records were actually mastered a little fast, and that's what made that eerie quality to his voice. And I've heard that you can buy the actual recordings now slowed down a little bit, and he sounds very much human with it. So it may take a little mystique about Robert Johnson away, but the story of the crossroads will never fade at Highway 61 and Highway 49 just outside Clarksville.
That's fascinating, and it's a really dark legend that started rock and roll, and certainly a lot of pop musicians have seemed to have made almost like a deal with the devil and then had a few years of fame and then fallen off that pedestal. Let's get into, what do you feel about backward masking? There was some talk for quite a while that some records were being produced backwards. There was a secret message, Led Zeppelin, Stairway to Heaven. What do you make of all that?
Well, basically, what I think, it's like if you took ink and you threw it on a white wall. The guy who throws the ink may have defaced a wall, but the person who comes by and sees satanic images in the paint, you know, that's his own personality that, or his own concept of looking through, I think that's the story to a lot of the backward masking. I think it's the beauty's in the ear of the beholder. But, you know, obviously, yeah, there were actual backward maskings that were placed on records, and I remember that. Oh, I guess it was the 1980s when CBS News announced that there were backward satanic messages in records. And it became a bit of a game, I guess, that everybody was trying to find these backward tracks. And a number of songs supposedly had them. And, you know, it was pretty interesting. Now, for instance, Electric Light Orchestra probably has the best backward track. I think it's on
ELO.
The El Dorado track. Are you familiar with that?
Sure. Which song is that?
I always say it's right after Fire on High, or right before Fire on High. It sounds like a chant. at the first of it, and it sounds dark and almost satanic, a lot of people would claim, because who knows what a satanic chant sounds like, but anyway, people were convinced that ELO had it. And when they played it backwards, you hear Jeff Lynne say, the music is reversible, but time is not. Turn back, turn back. And he goes, turn back four times. And they ask Lynne, why are you saying turn back? And he said, well, I figure that if you could hear this, then you were playing your record backwards and your needle was going to skip off the LP, so turn back and don't mess up your needle, is what he said. So that was pretty funny. Oh, yeah, it's always a joke. Yeah. And then the B-52s had a great joke with it. They had a backward track on one of their albums where one of the artists says, I buried my parakeet in the backyard. And he says, what are you doing? You're playing your record backwards. Watch out, you might ruin your needle. So Rain by the Beatles had the very first backward vocal track. And if you listen to the third verse, it sounds like John Lennon is chanting. But when you reverse the track, he's saying, when the rain comes, they run and hide their heads. Now, those are true backward masking. And basically, it's pretty simple because the track is recorded backwards and then mixed, and then it's recorded forward, then reverse, and then put into the mix, and you can hear it. And a lot of times, the Beatles used to use backward tracks on cymbals, which would give a sound like that in the background. So when Lennon had taken Rain home and the tape was accidentally reversed, he loved the sound, so he told George Martin just to reverse that sound. And that was the beginning of the whole backward track phenomena. Where people get confused is in the use of the phonetic reversal, which means that you would have to have a track, a hidden message. And if it was when the rain comes, they run and hide their heads, you would say that. You would reverse the track, and then you would listen to a series of phononyms, phonetic sound. And then what you would try to do is come up with some gobbledygook phrasing that when you set it forwards, when the track was reversed, it would be backwards. And this is the one where the voices go like this, you know, that real strange sound to it. And, of course, you know, the band who gets the most blame for the backward track is Led Zeppelin.
Stairway to Heaven.
Of course. And how many radio stations play that song on Halloween? You know, I mean, the first time you hear it, you know. What's kind of interesting is that if you really want to research the concept of the backward mask is to find songs that supposedly contain the track and then listen to it yourself without any explanation and see what you hear. And then once you're told what the message is, you seem to always hear it, and whether it's the idea that you really want to believe and you want to hear and it stands out. But the first thing that most people would do when they hear Stairway to Heaven, and of course the verse, if there's a bustle in your hedgerow, don't be alarmed now, which sort of nonsensical phrasing.
Yeah.
No. And when you play it backwards, a lot of people seem to have no problems hearing, here's to my sweet Satan. They hear the phrase sweet Satan. Now the other phrases, they may not hear. But to me it's pretty obvious that you can hear, here's to my sweet Satan, and then the next line I can hear with no problem, which is, the one will be the sad one who makes me sad, whose power is in Satan. And that's pretty clear. Now, the rest of it, to me, is a bunch of gobbledygook. But
it's
that
interesting
one,
because they had a lot of tragedy right after that. I mean, what do you think of this legendary pact they have made, members of Led Zeppelin with the dark side?
Well, let's take it from the beginning. I mean, when Led Zeppelin came out in 68, early 69, Jimmy Page was pretty well known, but he was probably the greatest sessions guitarist in England. And he played on so many tracks, especially Donovan's Sunshine Superman and Hurdy Gurdy Man and tracks for The Who. And so he was well known. And John Paul Jones was an arranger and a studio player, but he wasn't anywhere as well known as Page. And then you had these two guys, Robert Plant and John Bonham, who were 18 at the time, I believe. And they'd played in a band that no one had ever heard of. And the next thing you know, Led Zeppelin forms. And for some reason, they shoot straight to the top of the charts with a sound that was, at that time, very revolutionary and very Jeff Beck influenced, I would say. But still, it was cool. Yeah, very heavy, very different. So here you have a group of basic unknowns who've topped the Beatles. So the rumor goes out, how could this band that no one's ever heard of, how could they be so good and blow the charts away on their first album and their second album and the third album? So it goes back to Robert Johnson, doesn't it? You know, you can't be a superior musician without a little supernatural soliciting. So the idea was that Zeppelin had gotten together because Jimmy Page was a master student of the occult, especially Aleister Crowley, and he was a fan of Robert Johnson. So they had entered into a pact that would give them fame and and great music and following and all
for
this.
For 10 years. Right.
Oh, well, yeah. Let's see, that would be from when? 68, 69 to 79. It's kind of odd. It'd be almost 10 years, wouldn't it? When did Bonham
did they die? All? The legend is one of them didn't make the pact, correct?
Yeah, and what's
he was
funny?
The only one who got out of there without any sadness or tragedy.
Well, yeah, that's true. I mean, I think he did break a finger on his little hand one time, and they had to cancel the tour. But the story was that, you know, what you can do with your friends is you can say, you can tell the story about the blood pact, and then you can say, okay, name the members of Led Zeppelin. And it's real easy to say Jimmy Page, Robert Plant, John Bonham, and then a lot of people tend to forget John Paul Jones. And it's probably the easiest name. I mean, John Paul Jones, let's face it, American Admiral, American Revolution, easy name. But then the rumor is that Jones did not sign. And that's why his name is probably the last one on the list. And it is kind of interesting, though. And, of course, it was something that all rock bands wanted. They wanted their own mystique. They knew it sold records, and people would go out to see them. So why not whisper about dark signed passages and contracts and the occult, because people would come out and see it. So maybe it started out as a game. But as you said, there were some serious consequences with Led Zeppelin and some terrible luck that happened about the time
the drummer died.
Well, yeah, sure. You can't get worse than that, can you? But I was thinking that if you remember, Jimmy Page, the ultimate occult collector, had a shop in London called the Equinox, and he collected Crowley memorabilia, and he collected annotated manuscripts, ceremonial daggers, the robes, I mean, everything. But then he came upon the ultimate collectible, which was Crowley's home, the Lefkin House, which is on the banks of lovely Loch Ness. And the house had a dark history. First of all, it was built in the medieval times on the spot where a medieval church was burned to the ground with the entire congregation trapped inside.
Wow.
And then there was a beheading in the house. And people who spent the night in the house claimed to hear this sound that they thought cats were fighting, but it was actually supposedly the head of the decapitated man rolling down the stairs. So the house had a dark history even before Crowley. People who bought the house, there was stories of insanity, suicide, murders of the owners of the house. And when Crowley took it over, the story goes that he had unleashed a number of elemental demons and that they weren't bound properly or in controlled. And basically what happened at the end, when Crowley had moved from the house and Page bought it, there was a series of darkness about the home, and that Page believed the stories. And when I was working with VH1, we did a series called VH1 Confidential, and we actually interviewed one of the groundskeepers for Jimmy Page, and he said that Page had never spent the night in the house. They would come during the day, but when the sun went down, it was time to leave. Yeah. And
exactly.
What a story.
It's interesting, fun. You know, this is a metaphysical radio network, and a lot of us don't believe in an actual Satan with a pitchfork, but we do believe that there are lower entities and elementals who you can make pacts with, probably, and it can lead to a lot of problems as we go through these pop musicians. Let's switch over to the Eagles. Back when in the day when they had albums with jackets that you would open up and beautiful pictures, there's kind of a creepy picture in Hotel California of the band standing in the lobby, and then up in the staircase there's kind of like this, vampire or something. Why don't you tell us about that album cover and the lyrics to Hotel California?
Well, Hotel California probably was a defining point. Well, not probably. It was definitely a defining point in the Eagles' career. Bernie Leadon had left. Joe Walsh had come in. And the Eagles were crossing over from more of a country rock band to a driving rock band. And Joe Walsh had brought that in. And when Hotel California was written, Don Felder actually had written it, and Henley was writing the lyrics. And when the song came out, I mean, the story sounds so odd about references to checking out any time you like, but you can never leave. And the story about stab it with their steely knives, but they just can't kill the beast. And a lot of people were thinking that this song had to do with some sort of dark sacrifice, maybe a satanic sacrifice. So the rumor came out, when all the good people were looking for backward tracks with meaning, was the idea that the album Hotel California, and especially the song, referred to the Church of Satan in San Francisco, because the original church was an old brothel that had been a hotel, and it was located on California Avenue. So it sort of made sense to people when they put this thing in, you could check out any time you like, but you can never leave. And that was supposedly a reference to, like, Jane Mansfield, who was a member of the Church of Satan. And when her boyfriend, Sam Brody, an attorney, told her that her career would probably be destroyed if everyone knew that she was having her picture made drinking out of these ceremonial goblets with Anton LaVey, she quit. And then supposedly a curse was placed on Brody by LaVey. And LaVey told Mansell not to be alone with Brody. And sure enough, one night in Louisiana, they drew the limo they were in, the car, drove under a tanker truck. And the story goes that they were both killed. And the story was that Jane Mansfield was decapitated. And at the same time in San Francisco, when the accident occurred, that Anton LaVey had clipped out a picture of the Church of Satan. And when he turned it over, he'd noticed that he'd clipped off Jane Mansfield's head. And that sort of got some notoriety there. So the idea of Anton LaVey, the Church of Satan, played a dominant role. Now, when you look at the picture you're talking about, in the balcony, there's a figure looking down, his head shaven. Sure. He has a black goatee, he's dressed in black, and he's staring down. So when the album came out, it was Anton LaVey. Was the
it was him?
He was standing here. No, it wasn't. But it doesn't matter if it's the truth now, Mike. What it is, people said, oh, my gosh, it's Anton LaVey. And it did look like LaVey because of the shaved head and the beard. But the Eagles claimed, and this is their story, that it was a guy who was one of the extras in the picture, and he had gone to sleep in the balcony when they were taking the picture. He just woke up, looked over the side, and his picture was immortalized. Now, you can listen to Don Henley's account, or maybe it was Anton LaVey, but the whole story is the Eagles have constantly denied that the song had anything to do with the occult. It's more like a Twilight Zone story, according to LaVey. But I have heard that in Baja California, there's a fellow has purchased what he says is the actual Hotel California, and they're remodeling it. So if you'd like pink champagne on ice and mirrors in the ceiling, you might want to check in there. So we'll see.
The actual picture on the cover is from a hotel in Mexico? Where that hotel is.
You're supposed to be able to see the Mission Bell and all this. I was when I was in L.A., I guess it was 2 years ago, in the Times I was reading the article about this Hotel California the guy was remodeling it. I have it somewhere, so I thought it might be kind of cool to go out and see how close Don Henley was to the description of the place, you know. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the great urban legends with the Eagles. And, of course, it supposedly has a backward track, too. That when you play it backwards, you hear Don Henley say, oh, Satan, how he started his own religion. You know that he should. How nice. But that's not very clearly heard. But, you know, when you're playing everything backwards and you're looking for all hidden scoops and messages, you know, a lot of things sort of stand out. So that's what brings in the Hotel California to the backward phenomena.
Right. Now let's talk about some mysterious deaths. And, of course, we have to go with Jim Morrison. I think very few people saw the body in the coffin, and there's been a lot of talk that he may be alive in the northwest part of the country. What do you know about this?
Well, I probably know too much about it, but, you know, basically, I was involved in a radio show that talked about that to a great extent one night, and I was contacted by the manager of the guy who claims to be Morrison, I guess the man who would be Morrison in the Pacific Northwest. And he was telling me this incredible story about how Jim had escaped from Paris and that the CIA was after him. But the point I couldn't understand is if the CIA is after you and you're going to have to hide and go underground, why would you announce to everybody that you're living in a certain part of the state and, you know, come up and see me sometime, you know, and I'm doing radio shows now. But anyway, I was sent a few tapes, and it supposedly shows a morphing of this figure into Jim Morrison, or Jim Morrison into him. But, you know, the more I've studied the story, and I try to keep an open mind, even though there's a lot of things that, you know, I say, you know, there's no way that could be true. But I still keep that 1% because, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, what if he did escape? And like you're saying, let's go to Paris. When Morrison died, I think only three people ever saw the body, okay?
Right, his wife.
Morrison,
right?
Yeah. Well, Pamela Corson is one. And then the story goes that the guy who provided the drugs, and then Marianne Faithfull was another. And then she called over another friend to help her, you know, take care of the body. Now, this is a major issue because on July 3rd, and here's the thing, let's do the conspiracy bit. Let's go ahead and talk about that. You know that Morrison was in Miami, and he had been convicted of indecent exposure, but he hadn't been sentenced. So why does Morrison's attorney agree with Morrison to send him to Paris, of all places? And the answer is that France has no extradition treaty with any country for sexual crimes.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. What's kind of odd is Oscar Wilde also left England for Paris for the, you know, because of the sexual crime that he could not be extradited for. So Morrison goes to France because Morrison's attorney claimed that if Morrison was sent to federal prison, he'd be killed there. Now, to make it even more of a strange conspiracy, let's think of the Monterey Pop Festival. When Monterey was held, record companies are going out signing all these new acts. And at Monterey, you had Brian Jones, who organized it. You had Mama Cass, who was one of the organizers. You had Jimi Hendrix, who made his first appearance there. You had Janis Joplin, who made her first appearance there. You had Otis Redding, who made his. And 1 year later, they were all dead.
Yeah, they all died.
Yeah. I mean, what are the odds of that, the heads of the counterculture? And you look at the FBI files, and there were more FBI files on Jim Morrison than any other musician, probably because his father was an admiral in the Navy, whose career definitely ended when his son became leader of the counterculture. And Jimi Hendrix had a massive amount of FBI files, and so does Janis Joplin. Oh. So when Hendrix died first in September 1970, the story goes that Joplin said, well, I'm sure glad I didn't die today because Hendrix had got all the headlines. Well, that was all right. She was dead 2 weeks later.
Wow.
And then when Morrison was in Miami and he heard about the deaths of Janis and Jimmy, he turns to his friends and he says, you know, you're drinking with number three.
He knew, huh?
He knew. He knew something because in July 1971, Morrison was dead. Now, when he died, the story goes, and this is where we have to take it. The Morrison family was not told of Jim's death until after he was buried. So none of the family ever saw the body. Another thing that happened was Ray Manzarek had sent the Doors manager, Bill Siddons, to Paris. And before Bill left, Ray looks at him and says, Bill, make sure. Which is very strange because Bill, I
make sure he's dead.
Exactly. Knew, make sure what, you know? So he goes over to Paris. He finds Pam. He goes to the little apartment that they rented. And there in the middle of the apartment is this wood veneer, very cheap coffin. And the lid had been screwed into place. So he didn't see the body. He went to the funeral on the 8th. He saw the body laid into the ground, and then he left, and everyone else did. I think there were 8 people at the funeral. And then Pamela comes back. So if we take a look, if Morrison had managed to escape or he managed to fake his death, one of the stories that when I researched my book, Take a Walk on the Dark Side, I talked to Alan Graham, who is Jim Morrison's brother-in-law. And Alan told me the strange story about seeing a picture of a German musician whose name was Dietmar. And Dietmar was a big Doors fan, and he followed Morrison around. And he said that both men, Morrison and Dietmar, were standing next to each other. And he said, Gary, I swear to you, I could not tell who was who.
Wow.
So he said, if there was a conspiracy theory, what if Dietmar had died, who resembled Morrison? That gave Morrison a chance to get out of the country. But, you know, I've got to tell you, the Morrison family do not believe that Jim's alive. That this was one of the things that they first noticed when it happened. Now, if you remember, when Jim died, Pamela leased the grave. She didn't buy it. So in 1971, the grave was leased for 30 years, which meant in 2001, you know, someone had to take possession of the body. And we thought it was all going to work out because in Père Lachaise, if you've been there, there's graffiti everywhere from the 70s and the 90s, or not, you know, 70s, 80s, 90s, but now, when you go to Père Lachaise, all the graffiti's cleanly removed from the tombstones. You have 2 policemen on duty at all times around the grave, and they've got it blockaded off. But the Morrison family pays to have the graffiti cleared. They have a security system for the grave. And now the French have allowed to let Jim become the permanent American in Paris at Père Lachaise, and he's not going to be moved. And I know that Ray Manzarek said, I'm going to be there on July 8, 2001, and I'm going to say, open the box. Open the box. I remember that. But you know what was odd? I was in Paris on July 8th, 2001, just by coincidence. So I had to go to Père Lachaise. You know, I walked through and looked over Morrison's grave, and very peaceful scene. You know, no graffiti, 2 policemen on guard. But I guarantee you, when you go to that cemetery, there'll be 50 people walking aimlessly around, and they'll say, hey, do you know where Morrison's grave is? So you have to lead them in the right direction. So is Jim alive?
Legendary. Well, if one pop star could ever pull off a disappearance, I think it would be Morrison. But let's switch on to some other stars. Let's talk about James Taylor, his biggest hit, Fire and Rain. He has some unusual lyrics talking about Suzanne, the plans they made put an end to you and a plane crash. Tell me about that song.
Well, you know, it's kind of interesting because I think a lot of things we do with songs is that we tend to read things into them. And I noticed this when I wrote the book, The Walrus is Paul and the Paul is Dead Rumors, because the clues in that book were like the totally ridiculous, where people tried to make things fit. And then you had some of the clues that were, you know, guided looking, guided listening. And then you had some of the clues that obviously had to be planted by the Beatles themselves. Well, in the song Fire and Rain, the idea of Suzanne, supposedly the legend was, and you correct me on this, I haven't studied this in a while, but Suzanne was supposed to be a girl that Morrison, not Morrison, but James Taylor had met when he was going through some rehab center, and that she was killed in a plane crash, and the story goes that she was murdered. Well, it's real simple. The pieces of flying machine on the ground wasn't a plane crash. Remember what James Taylor Band was called?
No.
The Flying Machine. So when the band broke up, those are the pieces on the ground, you know, the dreams that are broken and shattered. So even though some of the songs have these great sinister sounding things with them, sometimes they're pretty easily explained.
Interesting. Now, how about pop stars who have died and there have been ghost sightings, perhaps in hotels or recording studios or something like that? Tell me about that.
Well, I suppose the most popular ghost in music history is Hank Williams. There's a nightclub in Nashville. It's called Tootsie's Orchid Lounge, and it's a little bit behind the old Ryman building. And the story goes that all the country artists, after they performed, they'd walk down to Tootsie's and they'd drink, and that Hank was one of the most popular visitors who would hang out there all the time. So after his death, it just seems that Hank's still seen around the Tootsie's Orchid Lounge. Matter of fact, there's constant sightings of him. Now, it's in Nashville, Tennessee, and as a native Tennessean, you know, I've been to Tootsie's, but I've not had a sighting of old Hank yet. But supposedly I think it was last year, there was a sighting of him standing in the upper area, and this ghostly figure dressed in his nudie suit, and, you know, it was Hank Williams, according to everybody else. So it can bring a lot of people in to drink a few beers at Tootsie's, but still, that's the most popular ghost. There have been stories of John Lennon's ghost appearing at the Dakota on the outside. Yeah, and there's a picture supposedly involving a figure that looks very much like Lennon standing outside the Dakota. I've heard that there's pictures of Morrison's ghost. I've heard that, I had a friend who sells real estate in Nashville who bought a condo that was once owned by Elvis. And she was remodeling it because it had this beautiful shag carpet, not only on the floor but on the ceiling and the walls too. And one of the bedrooms had a stage where when Elvis was off the road, he and his band would get in, they'd perform, and they had a recorder, everything in there. And she was watching television. She saw this ghostly figure standing next to the set, and she didn't recognize it until they went to the Pink Palace in Memphis, and they saw a picture of Elvis in his army uniform. And she said it was the exact thing. And when she went back, she brought one of her friends who was clairvoyant, and she tells him that they talked to the spirit. They told Elvis that, you know, there was nothing that he needed to be there and to go back and all this, and the spirit left. So I thought that was a pretty interesting story. Now, I mean, I hear stuff like this all the time. You know, I get all kinds of interesting emails, and I hope your listeners will send me some emails, you know, because I love to hear the stories. But, I mean, those are some ghost stories. I mean, Elvis in Nashville, and it seems like Nashville must be pretty good on the ghost end. I heard that the Red Hot Chili Peppers had a ghost on one of their albums that's actually been photographed. I think it might be, Blood Sugar Sex Magic? I think that I remember that they actually brought in some Ghostbusters into the studio. There's a studio in Nashville, I'll go back to Nashville again, called The Castle, that was used in Prohibition by some of the men from Al Capone's gang, and there were supposedly murders there, and there's ghosts. I have a friend, Leo Lyons, from 10 Years After, who's a psychic, and he claims at Regent Studios in Memphis that there's a ghost in the studio there that he confronted. So if you're recording, if you're in certain areas, you know, you may see some from ghosts from the rock and roll past. So who knows? Maybe rock and roll never will die.
Absolutely. How about the strange death of the Rolling Stones' first guitarist, Brian Jones? He was found dead in his own swimming pool. What do you make of that story?
That's one of the strangest stories. I mean, when you take Jimi Hendrix and Brian Jones and put them together, the sad thing about Jones's death was that when he died, he was not allowed to be buried with his family in the churchyard because his death was questionable, which meant it was either suicide or, you know, the concept it could have been suicide. So they would not let him be buried in the churchyard. They moved him into a public cemetery. But now it appears that Brian Jones was murdered. There's rumors of a deathbed confession by Frank Thurgood, who was one of the workers who had argued extensively with Jones, and Jones was supposedly going to fire Frank that night when he died. Witnesses have now come forward saying that they saw two men hold Brian Jones under the water and that they were threatened with their lives. And the girl that Jones was with that night left the country immediately after the funeral, not to come back. So the sad thing about Brian Jones, it appears that he was drowned, intentionally murdered, and that, you know, his whole idea that he's buried in a public cemetery and everything that has gone through with it. The sad thing is, I understand that British will not reopen the investigation because all the major figures are now dead, so there's not anything to really gain. But it just seems like a reputation would be interesting. Of course, the thing with Jones's death, they found his body at the bottom of the pool. And, you know, just in a matter of minutes, it's almost impossible for your lungs to fill with water for your body to sink completely to the bottom. So I think the Stones were pretty well convinced it was foul play.
Yeah, and there's a new movie coming out called The Stoned about Brian Jones, so that should be interesting to watch for. Real quick, we just have a few minutes left. Stevie Nicks has always had a mystical image. Is she into Wicca, or what do you think about Stevie Nicks?
I think Stevie got all the tongues talking when she did Rhiannon, you know, the Welsh witch or whatever, you know, and a story with that. I mean, I'm sure that, you know, I'm sure she's into metaphysics. So a lot of people, when they talk about rock and roll, they sort of get the idea when they talk about metaphysics, it has to be some sort of satanic practice. And a lot of people are always looking for answers, and some of the answers are spiritual answers. And when you talk about metaphysics, it's not necessarily talking about evil forces, even though
of course it could be.
But, you know, there's some, it depends on how people use anything with their energy. It can be evil or good, whatever. But basically, it's not set up to be that way. I mean, I think a lot of people, I mean, I think Stevie Nicks has got an interest, but I don't think that it's time to take her to Salem and burn her at the stake or hang her from the tree, you know. I mean, the whole thing about her ideas and all this is just basically a reaction of a 1980s society that was looking for the devil and everything. It was almost like a Salem witch trials. It was, you know, except for a yellow bird, it was a backward track, you know. But it's kind of interesting. I think when you look at the Crowley situation in England and all the devotees, is the idea that a lot of people took "do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law" is "it's your thing, do what you want to do," you know. And I think that was a lot of it, really was, you know. And I think that makes it kind of interesting.
The funny thing is, the guy who's very deep into metaphysics is Daryl Hall from Hall & Oates, although a lot of the public, I don't know if they're aware of that, and it doesn't seem to translate to his lyrics, but he's deeply involved.
Well, yeah, I think I read somewhere that he said that his great-grandfather, if he was alive, they would have burned him because he was a witch, and that Daryl Hall also is a major collector of Crowley memorabilia and Crowley manuscripts, so he has a deep interest in
He separates it from the music, yeah. A few more questions. Let's talk about UFOs real quick. Any UFO sightings with rock and roll? I know David Bowie claims to have seen one on television, and he taped it, and then it was never shown again in the news. What do you think about that?
Well, I think it's interesting. I mean, I know Bowie was, at one time, he was really deep into metaphysics and the occult. You know, he also was into Crowley. And I remember the story of the UFO with Bowie. I also remember the one with John Lennon at the Dakota when he was standing on the rooftop and he claimed to have seen a UFO. And that was a story. Another story I've heard about UFOs and rock stars has to do with Jimi Hendrix. I mean, if you've listened to Hendrix's lyrics, how many lyric concepts does he have of flying saucers? I mean, remember the song Up from the Skies where a spaceman comes and speaks to the audience, and then, what is it, Castles Made of Sand? There's a ship that takes them away at the end of it. And you have in A Merman I Should Turn to Be. I mean, all these ideas of science fiction. Even Purple Haze was written about a ray gun. You know, so Hendrix was really much into science fiction. Now, I've heard this, and this is basically a rumor, I've not confirmed it, that Billy Cox, the bass player with Jimi Hendrix at the end, claims that that they'd had a sighting of a UFO. And he recalled to a friend of mine that Hendrix had walked toward it and that it just seemed to blot out from his mind. So that's one of the things I want to look for. I want to hear Billy Cox tell me the story of the UFO and Jimi Hendrix, because I think that'll be interesting.
Absolutely. One last question about premonitions. Did Ritchie Valens from the movie La Bamba and the song, did he have a premonition of a plane crash and his death?
They all did. Ritchie Valens, one of the interesting things about Ritchie Valens was that when he was in junior high, at lunch he would take his guitar and he'd sit under this tree. and he'd play, and all his friends would gather around him. Well, he went to his uncle's funeral one day, and as they were leaving the funeral home, he sees a plane explode in the air. So they get in the car and they follow it, and the debris had fallen on his schoolyard. And under the tree that he sat, there was a huge piece of wreckage. He would have been killed that day. Matter of fact, one of Richie Valens' friends was killed in that accident. So that's when he developed his terrible fear of flying. His mother had a premonition that something would happen to him, but she was quiet because she knew it would destroy his career. And when his girlfriend, Donna, asked him, Donna Fox Ludwig, she asked him, she said, well, what would you do if the plane crashed? And he said, well, I'll try to land on my guitar. But the same night, a few nights before he left, and not the same night, but Buddy Holly had had a dream where he was flying a small plane. And he had landed on a skyscraper in New York, and he took his wife, Maria Elena, and she left the plane, and he left her. And he said he had this terrible feeling of the sadness, like he couldn't come back for her. And this was the day he left to go on the Winter Dance Party tour. Well, that same night, Maria Elena, his wife, had a dream where she was standing in a cornfield, and she saw people running toward her. And she looked into the sky, and she saw this huge burning ball of fire crashing into the ground. And this was the night before he left. So they both had the dream on the exact same night. Richie Valens had a premonition, and the Big Bopper had done a sleep-a-thon in Texas where he had stayed up for, set a record for going without sleep. And they had to carry him out on a gurney. He was exhausted. And he turned to one of the men with him. He says, you know, I just saw the other side. He said, I just saw my death. He said, you know, he said, it's not that bad. It's not that bad. So all three of them got
they're in rock and roll heaven right now.
Rock and roll, three stars.
We're flat out of time, Gary. I'm going to have you back because I have a lot more questions we didn't get to. Before you go, give us your website and some contact info for our audience.
Yeah, you can write me at www.rgarypatterson.com and send me an email, ask any question. I'll try to get back with you. I try to always answer my email, so you can contact me there. I love to hear news stories or get tips on great stories for me to research. And I have two books that you can find. Take a Walk on the Dark Side is my latest, and it's got all the stories, a lot of the stories we talked about tonight, and The Walrus's Paul about the Paul is Dead rumors. And you can, if you can find my second book, Hellhounds on Their Trail, I guess they call it a cult classic because it's got ridiculous prices. But the secret is, buy Take a Walk on the Dark Side, you can get it for $14, and you won't have to pay the $80 for the Hellhounds on Their Trail. It's basically a better version of that book. So write me
and
keep in touch.
We will definitely write to you. Thank you, Gary, for coming on the show. Take care.
Thanks, Mike. Had a great time.
Sure. Bye-bye. All right. That was a very well-known author, Gary Patterson. And go to Amazon.com and type in his name and check out his books. You know, just a wealth of fascinating anecdotes and stories. And I really wanted to have him on talking about metaphysics and mystical subjects within rock and roll. So now we go on to the next section of the Odyssey show, and my co-host, who is an intuitive psychic, will be on soon, and this is your chance to call in and get a free reading. Her name is Candia. She normally charges $100 an hour, and she's graciously allowed us to tap into free readings during the show. So this is a golden opportunity, and please call the main number on the website right now, actually. Start calling in. And to make sure you get on. So that's 877-876-5227. So now we'll go to the news of the day while I'm waiting for Candia to come on, and we'll have a little musical break when that happens. And I wanted to talk to you about, I read an article this week called 10 Disturbing Trends in Subliminal Advertising. And I wanted my audience to be aware of all the different types of very subliminal advertising going on in your day-to-day life. So if you're aware of it, you can you can stop spending so much money and be in control of your financial situation a little bit more, because you are being manipulated out in the marketplace. The first the first thing that's used or technique is point-of-sale mind control scripts. So if you go into a retail store or test drive a car, they're using certain phrases that they've tested with psychologists to kind of trap you into a corner. You know, would you prefer this one or that one instead of not buying anything at all? So watch out for upselling and these types of questions, and don't let them ever take your keys for your old car at a car dealership. Always keep your keys with you. That's one thing they also do to keep you there at the dealership. The second thing is doctor-patient drug kickbacks. A lot of drug companies actually bribe doctors and give them all kinds of cash bonuses, vacations, and perks if they prescribe certain medications. It's very shocking, but it happens. If you go to any doctor's office for a couple hours, you will see drug reps going in and out and in and out, very smartly dressed. So that's one thing to watch out for. Okay, we are going to take a little break now, have some music, and come back on with Candia. All right? Okay, we have a call. Go ahead, caller.
I made a mistake. I had a wrong number. Sorry.
Okay, thank you. So anyway, we're going to keep talking about these trends in subliminal advertising while we're waiting. Okay, we're back on with the Odyssey Show. Sorry about that, but Candy is actually on the road this week, so she may not be able to call in. So I'm going to continue with my article on subliminal advertising. Do we have a caller? Hello?
Yeah, I like your show. It's pretty fun show.
You. Did you have a question?
I have a, what do you guys usually do on the show? I have a question about that. Like, I'm a first-time call, so I was listening to the show. What do you guys usually do on the show?
What do we do on the show?
Yeah.
We talk about ancient mysteries and mystical topics, actually. There's a lot of archives on bbsradio.com. Okay, we're back on the air with Odyssey, and we have our first caller of the night for Candia, our intuitive psychic. Go ahead.
Hello, good evening. Hello.
That's okay. Candia, we were talking about pop musicians and stars who are involved in metaphysics tonight.
Oh,
I know. It was a great topic. And we didn't get to Elvis Presley, but a lot of people don't know this, but he was a healer. He actually would lay hands on people and heal them.
That part I didn't know, but it doesn't surprise me because he was so religious. You know, he's very Christian, religious. It was very much a part of his upbringing and who he was. So that doesn't surprise me at all, because if you think about it from the South, it makes perfect sense, because it's much more charismatic, the religious context. So laying on of hands is very much a part of that aspect.
He got into metaphysics later in his career, actually. He kind of started studying Eastern philosophy, so... That's one aspect of his life. A lot of people don't know that. Yeah. So we have time for some calls from the audience, okay, for free readings, right? Why don't you tell us what you've been up to, and we'll have people call in and talk to you.
That would be awesome. Well, this past weekend, I had a great workshop, of which I call a fun shop. I taught a class on relationships. So, of course, because that was been my focus of gearing up for the class, the last several weeks, the clients that I've been working with, most of their challenges have been wrapped around relationships versus health or money, and, you know, jobs, that type of thing. It's been more relationship driven. So this weekend we had a great time working through all different kinds of layers upon layers of relationship. And for me, of course, it's relationship with yourself first and foremost, because that's where all relationships begin. It's with yourself. And I'm sure you know that from doing what you do as well. I'm not teaching you anything new or telling you anything new, because you work with people all the time like I do. And it's been really fun, because everybody looks at me like, well, does it have to be always about me? And it's like, yes, it does. Because like today, one of the women I was working with, she was dealing with a relationship of about a year and a half, and the man she's been living with is, she just found evidence of having an affair with someone else. And so, of course, she's upset and, I was going to say, out of her mind with fear and worry, because that's really what happens, is the fear and worry takes over. And the bottom line is it all goes back to her. So how does that figure into our world, where if someone has an affair, how does it come back to us? Well, it's about our relationship to ourselves. first of all, to have enough self-confidence and self-esteem to draw the line in the sand to say, if that's what you want to do, that's great. Okay, go have a great life. Because if your expectation of having a good relationship with someone doesn't have room for that, then that's, and you don't worry about it, it usually doesn't happen. It was a self-fulfilling prophecy because in the back of her mind, there's always been that little worry and fear that that's what's going to happen because that's been a very repeated pattern in her life. Once you understand the patterns in your life as to why you do knee-jerk reactions, that's when you have the ability to finally change them.
Well, let's get somebody to call in with a relationship question. How about that?
Yeah.
Let's call in 877-876-5227. So what else went on in the fun shop, workshop?
Workshop, fun shop, well, I told stories. I started out, of course, telling stories about relationships because relationships, to me, are some of the most fascinating dramas that we spin for ourselves. So, and like I've said so often, when I read people, I tend to forget afterwards because I'm in their energy and step back out. There are those, though, that I have written down or kind of cataloged in my memory to talk about, to remember. And what happens, you know, there's usually a triad or a combination of a relationship between someone's father, their mother, and how it influences their lives. An example of this is a woman that was sabotaged quite heavily as a young girl by her mother, and it didn't matter what she did, her mother never would give her any kind of accolades or pat on the back, because of course relationships are on every level, whether they're with our spouses, our children, our parents, our friends, our cousins, our neighbors. There are multitudes of relationships. We always want to think of it as...
Oh, do we have a caller?
Yes.
Caller, go ahead.
This is Christine.
Hi, Christine.
Hi.
Where are you calling from?
I'm in Santa Monica, Los Angeles.
Oh, great area. How are the fires down there?
Well, I think they're out as far as I know, but I haven't been listening to the news too much lately.
No, that's not a bad thing either.
I know.
So wait, what's your question tonight?
Oh, I guess my question would have to do with my current situation with relationships. I'm going through a breakup, and it's been very, very difficult. It actually happened several months ago in September. So,
how long were you guys together?
7 years.
Married or not?
Married for the last two.
Funny how that works. You get together, and then you finally get married to make the final, ultimate commitment, and it's right after that that things get more challenging.
Yeah.
It happens a lot.
Yeah, it was kind of a big surprise for me. And a real big disappointment because it was the first time I had been married, and I waited until I was 52 to get married, and then it just didn't work out for more than 2 years. Which, you know, I know time isn't the ultimate thing or reason for things to keep going.
Well, you know what? If I were to look at right now you're in the grieving process.
Still, yeah.
It's a tough thing, divorce. I've been divorced. It sucks. I'll be real honest with you. It's not fun, and the grieving period takes a period of time. However, my sense with you, of course, my adage is it's all about us, is on some level, even though you can tell me consciously that you were taken by surprise, on some level, those last 2 years of your relationship, it feels like the word I'm hearing is more frozen, meaning that the communication had already started to dry up.
Yes, that's probably true.
And that the two of you were not communicating in the way that you once were. It feels almost as if by that final commitment of the piece of paper, the ring, it actually triggered what I would say in both of you, fear. And it only is amplified, too, by the mere fact that you waited until you were, you know, midlife to get married in the first place, that fear of commitment is huge for you.
Hmm.
And then to get married and finally commit, once you did, it's like you almost, what I would say is you were triggered into what I would call past programming, mm-hmm. you know, which comes back to your childhood, how your parents interacted with one another, how they interacted with you, whether they were with you or where they were not, depending on where you were in your family and the lineup of your family. All of that interplays to the to the reactions, and I literally mean knee-jerk reactions to situations and how you are triggered by past events in your life. It's the same with him, so that when you guys get to that point, you're literally operating from something in your past rather than operating from a present conscious.
I don't know. I feel like on my part, it was more a naivete or a trusting position. And from his position, I felt it was more of like he was using me, and because I was his fourth marriage, and I don't know, things just.
Yeah, but I'm going to call you on something. Nobody can use somebody unless the other person agrees. None of us can say we've been used because we're all participants. I'm one of those who's a real firm believer in responsibility, and nothing happens to us. On some level, we agree to it. Mm-hmm. I can take that stance and say, well, I was controlled. Well, hello, I was controlling in another way, or I allowed it to happen. It's the way it is in any situation. None of us are ever victims.
Yeah.
We're all participants because on some level, we still agree. But the big thing for me with you is where I feel that things went sideways is this lack of communication and this lack of emotional connection between the two of you. Like I said, what I really feel is that they got frozen. Your emotions became frozen between the two of you, and that the communication just dropped down till, you know, he decided to check out.
Yeah.
Now, of course, there's two sides to it. He's not dealing with his own emotional stuff either, but this is a wonder. You know, this is really hard to say at the point you're going, God, this is horrible, this sucks, this, I'm grieving. However, it's a wonderful opportunity to really assess your participation in it, where your own sense of communication broke down, so that when the next day comes, literally, that someone else walks into your life, you're coming at it from a fresh start, an ability to communicate from a new level. Because everything that we're given in life, we can learn from. And I really trust you in the sense that you're a kind, caring, intelligent woman, and you're not going to stop your growth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're just not going to do that. You're going to reach in there and you're going to dig through it and say, okay, what did I get from this? What am I going to learn? So that it doesn't stop you in any way in the future. In fact, it will propel you forward into something really good. Even though right now that's hard to imagine because, again, you're going through the grieving process. It's like, in essence, it's almost like you lost a child from it, too.
Yeah.
Mhm.
Mhm. Well,
and that's another part of it, actually, the child aspect of it.
Mhm.
I don't know if you ended up mothering him at all, but there's definitely this feeling of loss of a child. Now, if you believe in other lifetimes, I really do believe in the concept that at one point in time he was your child, and so it was very easy for you to, in this life, for you to nurture him at that level, mother to son, which is really not good for the bedroom. But we as women have a tendency to do that.
Mm-hmm.
We do. We tend to nurture and mother our men, which is the wrong approach, because who wants to go to bed with their mother? It doesn't work.
Well,
so,
yeah, I don't know. I don't really resonate with that so much as far as he and I, but I understand what you're saying. That is true.
Well, I do feel like, though, there was a loss, like a child,
mm-hmm.
out of this. You know, and maybe it's because you finally agreed to getting married, and you nurtured the marriage as a child, you know, as something special.
Mm-hmm.
But
that's
also,
I
feel like that in another life he was your child.
Hmm. Okay.
You know, there are never any accidents. We always come back together for other reasons.
Right.
So this is just an opportunity for you to dig in and see where your participation was. I'll give you an example with myself. And I like to think of myself as, I always do a good job. You know, I'm going to put it together 100%. But it took the retrospect of the divorce to look back and say, okay, what did I do to contribute to this? Where did I go south? And I would point the finger at my husband and say, well, he's very controlling. Well, the reality was I was also controlling in my own aspect of the marriage. I created walls. I broke down and did not. I stopped communication along the way. I put the kids between us. So it's a matter of really being willing to look in your mirror and say, okay, what did I do so that you can change that? And that's your best key for growth,
mm-hmm.
and help you get through it.
Okay.
And that way you recognize that it's not all him. It never
mm-hmm.
is.
Mm-hmm.
But we as women like to think that we're self-righteous and wonderful and all that, but it's really not true. It takes both of us.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thank you very much.
I appreciate you calling in.
I appreciate your wisdom.
Thank you.
Thank
Have
you.
A good night.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye. I want to thank Christine for calling us tonight here on the Odyssey program on BBS Radio. It is now almost 9 o'clock. If anybody else is, my 1 o'clock says almost, this one says a little after. If anybody else is wild and crazy and wants to give me a call, I will keep the phone lines open one more minute or two. If you are at all interested in calling, check on the website right there and get the number and give us a call. And I will be more than happy to answer anybody else's questions tonight. Again, tonight I'm focusing on relationships because it's been my main focus for the last couple of weeks. And, of course, I am the true romantic at the same time the extreme cynic on relationships, too. I think it's from being on the planet long enough. I think there's a lot of groundedness that we want to all have that. Actually, every time I think about Romeo and Juliet or Elizabeth and Richard Burton, I mean, everything has a tragic side to it. But, you know, we all have that Cinderella concept that we all want to grow up and find the Prince Charming or the Cinderella. Well, there's also the reality of life gets in the way. And yet, like I said, I'm the true romantic. So for me, in doing readings with people, relationships are the most exciting because when you're 99 years old and you're getting ready to, you know, see that last sunset of your life and you're looking back on your life, what is it that really triggers you? What are the things that you really remember? It's not the fact you just made some big hot sale or that you lost the deal. No, you'll remember Joe, who you worked with, who was really funny and brought a sense of humor into the workplace. You'll remember all your relationships along the way and the emotional activation that you got and the humor and the love. Those are the things you remember. It's not the work along the way. It's the relationships. That's what life is all about, is this heatiness of that springtime love and the earthliness that we can have in a relationship that makes it so exciting. So with that in mind, really concentrate on communication in your relationships, because if you cannot communicate, first of all, with yourself so that you communicate your truth with everyone else around you, that's when you have the ability to turn your life around and change it. And then again, as you look back from that sunset on life, all of those relationships, you will have a richer, fuller life, because again, that's what life's about, is love and romance. Again, the true optimist and romantic here, relationships are what it's all about. And it's the emotions that we have in life that then affects our mental and our physical bodies. And most, if not all, in my opinion, I'm going to say in my opinion, dis-ease in our body is emotionally based. It just is. It's triggered, and it can be overridden. Any kind of dis-ease can be overridden by healthy, happy attitudes. So good, happy things to think about, things to really be very conscious about in your thinking. You know, it's all about conscious actions rather than knee-jerk reactions. So with that, you guys have a fabulous week. I gave you a few more minutes. No one called in on those words. I wish you adieu. Have a wonderful, fun-filled, action-packed, conscious thinking week. Stay tuned to the program next week here at Odyssey on BBS Radio. Also, check out some of the other programming that Don has here on BBS, because he has some fabulous programs available for those who have, you know, room in their lives for open-minded thinking. So please stay tuned to this fabulous station. And we thank Don again for creating this so that we can do these fun programs for everyone. So again, stay tuned next week here at BBS on the Odyssey program. This is Candia Sanders. Have a great week.